I'm Dean Olscher, here with the last act of this special presentation of The Designated Mourner by Wallace Shawn. Here's what's happened so far. Somewhere in an unnamed country, there are three characters. Howard, a dissident writer, played by Larry Pine, his devoted daughter Judy, played by Deborah Eisenberg, and Judy's husband, Jack, played by Wallace Shawn. A violent insurrection has broken out in the country, and in response, the government has intensified its repression. Many of Jack and Judy and Howard's friends have been murdered. Even Howard has been brutally beaten up. Jack begins to have mental problems. He walks out on Judy and never comes back. As we mentioned earlier, the New York production of The Designated Mourner was staged in a rundown former men's club on Wall Street. In the parts that we've heard so far, everyone in the audience was sitting in old club chairs. Paint was peeling from the walls. The place was deliberately chosen by director Andre Gregory for its eerie decrepitude. For the final act of the play, as New Yorker theater critic John Lahr explains, everybody had to get up and move.
Andre led us down to the floor beneath, which was a squash court.
A destroyed squash court, which was sort of like going into the Lubyanka prison in Moscow.
Toward the far wall was a sofa. And on that sofa were the back of Deborah Eisenberg's and Wallace Shawn's heads. And you came forward and passed them and took your place on some bleacher seats facing the door that you just came in and looking down at them.
It was a severe physical environment. And that severity carries over into the sound environment, too. There's an intentionally spare production here. Almost no sound effects, just disembodied voices. One last reminder, this play contains language that some people may consider offensive. Join me now for the last act of The Designated Mourner, which begins with a postcard that Judy has received from Jack, who has left her.
Then one day there was a funny postcard with a picture of an outdoor restaurant. No salutation, no signature. It said, in a very pretty garden, I ate lunch without you today, at a wobbly table with a thin rose crawling bent and unbalanced out of a tiny vase. I ate an egg and didn't think about you.
I stayed in a little hotel for a while, an adorable hotel. Whitewashed walls, fruit, a few plants, and that was about it. Except I kept having, guess what, memories. Not particularly painful memories, but I was brooding a lot about an article I'd read that had some interesting pictures that had accompanied it. I was thinking particularly of two specific pictures of the very nice, good-natured actor who was the subject of the article. And the first picture showed him when he was kissing his wife. And then the second picture showed him when he was acting in a movie and he was kissing the woman who played his wife in the movie. And he looked exactly the same in both pictures. And when I first read the article, I'd said to myself, he's lying. He's a liar. He's lying in one of these pictures at least. But now, as I thought about it, I thought, wait a minute, no. He's not lying. He's not lying because he's not pretending to be the same person in both pictures. Jesus Christ, that actor wasn't lying. I'm the one who's lying when I keep on pretending that I am the same person. The same person that I was this morning? The same person that I was yesterday? What's that all about? And why do I do it? Why am I struggling so hard every day to learn my lines, to once again impersonate this awful character whom I somehow believe I've been chosen to play? I feel exactly the way a criminal must feel, struggling so hard every day to stick to the story he was telling yesterday. The alibis, the lies, the interconnected details. It can't be done. You can't remember it all. So why do I keep trying to pretend to be the same when in fact my body is simply a shell, waiting to be filled by one person and then another. After I'd stayed in the hotel for several weeks, I developed the habit of wandering in the park. And one day in the middle of the park, I was standing at a lemonade stand, drinking lemonade, and I happened to meet a very sweet girl. She was with some friends, but she was standing apart from them, and I don't know why. I felt I'd feel comfortable talking to her, so I just started talking, and she responded in a quiet little voice. Her little pink mouth was so small, it was just like a tiny little mouse mouth, really. Her skirt, like a little bit of foam from the sea. Her shoes, like miniature containers for sewing equipment. We talked for a while, and her friends then said they were going to leave, but she stayed behind, and we kept on talking. In that quiet little voice, she told me about a sensation she said she'd been experiencing recently.
"Almost as if I'm in a picture," she said, "and something smudged it."
"Is there also almost like a sort of funny silence?" I asked her.
"Yes, I think so."
"Well, don't you know what that is?" I said with a laugh. "I think that's despair." I went out for a while with the lemonade stand girl. I had an affair with her, you see. Shall I tell you the rather subtle approach I used to lure her into it? Well, we were standing there by the lemonade stand, and it was getting dark, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, "Would you like to have an affair with me?" Wasn't that clever? She responded by touching me a little bit crudely. Then she introduced herself. Her name was Peg, and we went to her apartment. I often cried in bed when Peg and I made love, because I felt like a lamb who was feeding on grass. And folktales tell us that happy lambs quite often cry. Holding me in her arms, Peg was limitlessly kind. Her goodness was sort of like an ocean, really, and I was free to swim in it, and I swam and felt free. You know, I'd always wondered, how can people say that they're moved by nature? How could that be possible when the tree, the flower, have really no meaning? No one made them. No one intended anything particular by them. So how can people say that they mean something? Is that not like the belief of someone insane who thinks the raindrops on the window are bringing him a message? No, not at all. Lying next to Peg, I saw I'd been wrong. It was so easy now just to look at her shoulder, her neck, her cheek, and feel a kind of direct communication, as if her body were literally speaking to mine. As if I could hear things now, a stone talking, or a tree stump at night, or the moon. Anyway, things didn't work out with Peg. She got tired of me. Maybe my problem was just having always been very unhappy. Unhappiness being a kind of cold sort of marshland in which other emotions just refuse to grow. One day, lying on a beach after swimming, our teeth chattering, her goosebumped skin pressed close against mine, she said,
"Jack, I love you."
And I thought, what does she mean? Is she talking about me? My name rang so oddly in my ears.
Each night, alone in the house with Father, I'd go to bed late. I'd fall asleep instantly as if I'd been clubbed. Then 3 hours later, I'd wake up again, sweaty, terrified, my heart pounding. Lying in my bathtub in the dark, I'd twist back and forth under the little stream of water as if an invisible person were whipping me brutally. Mustn't touch myself, I'd think that would be bad. The wrong direction. All Father's friends were putting pressure on me as if I were the one who had all the answers somehow. As if I could explain what was going on. Why? Why me? I'd wait and wait. And finally dawn would come and the distant sound of violence, that vague, low roaring and groaning, the snapping of guns, would finally grow quiet, or almost quiet. That heartsick feeling didn't go away, though, the oppression, the awfulness. But sure, it was soothing, it was comforting to feel the sweetness of the morning air, to hear the birds, the insects. Every once in a while, I'd still sometimes throw on some earrings and a dress and go to a party at some embassy or other and chat with the bureaucrats, the wives, the rising young couples. But I learned nothing. Really nothing beyond the obvious fact that half the high officials were in their 20s now.
Eventually, I realized there wasn't any hope. An important insight. There'd be no happiness in my own life, nor would peace be won in the world at large. Was there anything, then, that I could expect to achieve in the coming years? Well, perhaps I could learn how to train my mind to focus less compulsively on terrifying images of death and disease. Maybe I could learn to pass more easily from one moment to the next, the way the monkey, our ancestor, shifts so easily along from branch to branch as he follows the high road through the forest at night. Let me learn how to repose in the shade of a nice square of chocolate. A nice slice of cake. A delicious cup of tea isn't perhaps that hard to come by. The trick to be learned is just not to think of other things while you drink it.
The radio broadcast some absurd message. There were to be some new people in high positions, some new policies, all very vague, but from the tone of it, you knew it was going to be bad. Everyone was talking on the telephone all day, and most of the old friends, the ones who were left, wanted to come over to the house. We knew we wanted to be together. Father got inspired and decided to cook. So that afternoon around 5, they all came, shambling through the courtyard into the garden, to stand once again under the stiff little trees with their frozen buds. The sky was gray. The breeze was icy. Mary was there. And Herbert, and Arthur, Bob, and Sam. Sam brought a jar of Indian chutney, which made a nice complement to Father's meat. As dusk fell in the garden, we could hear these really extraordinary sounds. You know, the boom of explosions and very loud shots. We knew they were nearer than they'd ever been before. Still, we sat at the garden table, or strolled near it, eating the meal that Father had prepared. The odor of the flowers was peculiarly strong, as if their last drops of perfume were being squeezed out in the knowledge that no one would be able to smell them later. No one ate much, but we all ate something. Finally, as the sounds of shooting grew louder, we all drifted inside. It was pure mindless instinct. A light, almost invisible drizzle had begun, so we pretended to ourselves that we simply were going inside to keep dry. There were ominous, silent flashes, a bluish tint to the air, and the dusk deepened. Inside, we all stood in the kitchen, moving unnaturally slowly and quietly, no one standing too close to anyone else. "Listen," Bob said. We all listened, and we heard birds approaching, flapping, flapping, an almost equestrian sound, sort of like the proverbial thunder of hooves. "Well," Father said, "I'm not exactly known as a superstitious man, but surely the appearance at such a time of such an enormous crowd of birds." And then no one spoke for a long time, each one just shifting his weight from foot to foot in his own little circle. I suddenly got a terrible cramp in my stomach, and I leaned over and I opened my mouth, and light seemed to pour out of it onto the ground. I could feel, as if it were happening to me, the penis of every man in the room slowly starting to rise. I was crouched over, close to the ground, surrounded by a forest of men, each with a branch at the groin sticking sharply up. And then with a crack, the rain was suddenly beating down on the garden, rattling wildly at the windows. And after a little time, through the roar of the rain, I heard the sound of breaking glass, as if bottles were being thrown and broken, and the grinding gears of a truck pulling up, stopping in the driveway, just where the milkman's truck always used to stop. Would they ring the bell like the milkman always used to do, to give us the bill? We drifted into the living room. Arthur sat in a chair. So did Mary, Herbert. And their bodies sort of slowly curled up in the chairs. Their expressions really were just waiting. A little bit puzzled, sort of like patients sitting in their pajamas in hospitals. Then there were sounds of commotion in the garden. At first, no one even went to the window to find out what was happening. I finally did, though, and in the darkness and the rain, the light from the house picked out a few spots I could see on the lawn. A patch of flowers, some dishes, food. Then by the table where we'd all had our meal, I saw a dead person lying. An old man, his skull had been crushed. He was lying in the mud, face downward, the rain pouring over him, the inside of his head washing out onto the lawn. As a child, I always used to read about biting down on cyanide capsules, and I'd imagine the faint taste of the gelatin of the capsules, or the painful, frightening bits of glass if the capsules were of glass. And I actually wondered, as all this happened, if such things as cyanide capsules existed any longer. I thought of the weight, the heaviness of Jack as he lay on top of me. And then it was almost funny because it was so exactly what one had always imagined. They knocked on the door. So yes, we landed exactly where we knew we would land, like parachutists, like the last bits of a puzzle. We floated down into the space that had been waiting. And once it was happening, it seemed right, and all the times we'd prayed, "God, don't let it happen," seemed far away. I excused myself, went upstairs to the toilet and vomited, then I brushed my teeth and came back downstairs, and I was more or less fine, shivering a bit as we walked out into the rain, but still perfectly able to walk to the truck. God, I'd spent a lifetime being afraid of being locked in a cell, of being slapped in the face, of being punched, of being watched by someone while I sat on the toilet. In 1 second, it all dropped away. I let go of it in a second, like opening a fist, letting a bird out of a cage. Not the sound of a door closing. It felt like the sound of a door opening. A girl whom someone has locked in her room. Then the sounds of her footsteps clattering as she bursts out and runs outside.
Judy and Howard and their friends went to prison. It seems fantastic to say that. I never thought I'd be saying that sentence about people I knew. They went to prison. And it was a hard time, and a long time, 5 years. Arthur and Bob, well, they died fairly soon. You know, if there was a draft coming through a window in a restaurant, it was too much for Arthur. So I suppose you can imagine that the famously cold, famously damp climate of our rather famous local prison didn't agree with him at all, or with Bob either. They shriveled up like little mice and died. Mary, a bit hardier, lived 3 years, and Herbert 4, and then finally Sam died, and well, by the time the 5 years were up, only 2 of the old gang were there to be released. Judy, by decades the youngest, and can it be true? Guess quick before I say. Yes, that's right. The other one was that terribly delicate, terribly infirm old man, Howard. God, what a surprise. Of course, the funny part was that by the time they got out, Howard naturally was in the best of health, but Judy was sick with something or other, one of those illnesses that keeps going away and then coming back. One night when Judy and Howard were in prison, I was at a party, sort of stuffing myself with cheesecake and pie, and I started talking with this rather eccentric, rather dizzy older woman. I guess she was drunk. I know I was. She looked like she didn't go to parties all that often, and the outfit she wore was somewhat bizarre. Anyway, I suddenly had a blinding revelation. "Wait," I said, "you're Joan." And I was absolutely right. Isn't that amazing? It was the legendary Joan. And because we were drunk, we had a long, frank talk. And at one point she asked me, "Well, what was your problem with Howard, basically?" "Oh, I don't know," I said. "I guess it was how much I hated him, really." "Yes, exactly. That was my problem, too," she heartily agreed. To be quite frank, one has to admit that those were not bad years for a lot of people. A lot of people were getting by, not doing that badly, or even doing a bit better than that. I myself had a pretty good job. I wrote a column on sex for the Morning Urinal, as everyone absolutely insisted on calling it. It wasn't really such a terrible paper, but people just loved to make fun of it for some reason. It showed people's boldly independent spirits, I suppose. Poor Howard certainly didn't get to celebrate much after he got out of prison. Actually, it might seem to be, you know, a little absurd to lock somebody up for 5 years and then have someone come to his house and shoot him, all basically because of a couple of essays he'd written several decades before. But you have to understand that no one person plans these things. Person A decides the first thing. Person B decides the second. I mean, you know, that's just how it works. Someone had a fetish about mealtime shootings, one is bound to conclude. He was in his bedroom, and Judy had just brought him a plate of cold meat and salad. Once again, it was, "Don't get up," the guy walking behind him, the hole blasted into the back of his head, the blood pouring endlessly onto the plate. When I heard about it, of course, I went over to see Judy. And then a month later, she sold the house, and I went over again to help her pack things up. Oh, my God, that whole thing of moving. So depressing. The sale of effects. The garage cleaned. Even the oil stains partially removed by means of some new process. The books in boxes carried down the stairs, ever so gently as if they were crates of eggs. I felt a sadness on the stairs as we took down the books, as I hadn't really when we'd carried down the corpse. Carrying the corpse down the stairs, I'd only felt, well, he won't be going down these stairs again.
We went away together, and we spent the night in a dirty little town way out on the water. The hotels were all closed, all the fancy places, the big restaurants. It was the off-season. For whatever reason, we didn't bring anything warm enough to wear. We were both freezing. Well, it was a dark, black, starless, moonless night with gusts of wind banging like fists on the windows of the little inn where we finally found a place to stay.
We walked up a narrow little flight of stairs with piles of old towels thrown on the landings. We turned a peculiar bent key in the door.
I had to hold on to the doorknob for a moment to keep from fainting. There was no heat in the room at all.
"What about me?" I asked her. "What about me? Did you worry about me when you were away?" She told me she found my sweater quite nice. Very nice colors. I cried a little. Then a bit more. Dribbling, you know. So love, apparently, was the last thing to go, and I was apparently the last one there to see the end of it. I watched the little flame as it sputtered and spattered, bent its head, and turned into a vague little plume of smoke. Oh, well. So that's how it went. Who would have guessed? I didn't really want to, but I put my hand around Judy's waist and held her next to me. It was a small gesture which could lead to nothing. My dick lay limply inside my trousers, like a little lunch packed by Mother. I decided to untie the rope that served me for a belt, and it turned out there was a fireplace there in the room. We made a fire and sat barefoot in front of it.
Outside, the wind swept the boardwalk of sand. It swept the porch. And inside our little room, I tried to hold him, to console him. It was like holding onto a nervous little piglet. He kept slipping away. Meanwhile, some awful trick of the night or the mind made me remember him as he'd once been. His confidence, the warmth, the directness of his touch.
A burden was lightened now that love was gone. It had always been a difficult word for me.
His skin felt like cold clay. I wanted to bathe him, to play with him, to bring him back to life. But that couldn't happen. Almost all of him was dead.
In my dream, blue smoke was blowing through the room. The barn door creaked, the cows mooed. I lifted off the ground, feeling very dizzy, dropping ashes faster and faster.
The next morning my head felt hot. The old symptoms again. As soon as we got back, I put the last of my cartons into a taxi and finally moved out to the apartment I'd found, out in that very quiet suburb up where Joan lived. The first thing I did there was to buy some white shirts in the local market and a pair of sandals. And almost every day, long before dawn, while it was still pitch dark, I'd get up, dress, walk through the little town's empty streets, then down the highway down to the beach. Darkness, the sea, the lighthouse, the gulls, the sand, thick and wet like black ice cream. Did I judge you? Sure I did, of course, but never mind, you'll be forgiven by cooler heads. Probably after death, unfortunately, but that's better than never. The effort people make simply amazes me. Just to get up, get dressed. It's not that easy. To feed oneself. To wash the dishes. I can't believe people do it year after year.
After the night I saw Judy, I lost my job. But I kept up with my habit of wandering through the city, and there was another thing that began to happen, where every time that I thought the word I, it sort of echoed or rang out in my head, and I was troubled by it. The idea of the self was obsessing me now. What were we constantly talking about? The self? What was the self? Well, one afternoon, one cloudy, drizzly late afternoon, I was sitting in my apartment writing in my diary, and unfortunately, I'd managed to spill my tea. And my hands were all wet, and so was my diary and my clean laundry and a bunch of forks and the clothes I was wearing. And as I grabbed a rag and started to wipe things up, I suddenly understood it very, very clearly. And the clarity made me queasy, as if a door had opened and bright light and oxygen had flooded into my brain. As the rag sat soaking in the tea on my lap, I understood that myself was just a pile of bric-a-brac, just everything my life had quite by chance piled up, everything I'd seen or heard or experienced, meticulously, pointlessly piled up and saved. A heap of nothing. A heap of nothing which had somehow been compressed into some sort of a form, and which had somehow succeeded in coming alive, and which quite ridiculously now demanded tribute, declared itself great. And the amazing thing was that I'd gone along with it. We all had. All had bowed down. We all had worshipped, each one kneeling before his own separate self, each one obsessed by a single question to the exclusion of everything. What will happen to this self which is mine? Will I achieve magnificence and success? Will I be admired? Will my marvelous self express itself? How idiotic! And how boring! How boring, how boring, how boring. And was this obsession even sincere? I wondered if the show of adoration wasn't perhaps just a bit overplayed, if all the overacting didn't perhaps reveal an element of pretense. And as I thought all these things, I felt I saw, standing by the window in the fading light, that very creature, that self which was mine. That ludicrous figure whom I'd approached till now with such ostentatious displays of respect, such fervor, groveling, hand-kissing, and tears. And I went up to the figure, the unpleasant little self, and I sort of grabbed it by the arm and spun it around toward me. And then I threw it on the ground and kicked it smartly in the face. And then I sat on top of it and grabbed its neck and choked it and strangled it and bashed its skull against the floor until it stopped squealing, stopped howling, gasped, and was gone. And what a fucking relief it was! All the posturing, all the seriousness, the weightiness that I was so sick to death of. I never have to do any of it ever again. I would walk down the streets like a cheerful ghost, and no one would know my secret. It would really be funny. And of course I saw immediately all the implications. I could be anything now, whatever I wanted. If I was a ghost, I could walk through walls. It would be so much easier than knocking on doors and begging someone to let me in. And I thought of something simple that I could say to people that they would all understand. I would simply say, "I guess I've always really been a lowbrow at heart. I guess I've always really been a lowbrow at heart." So I made a new life, and I was so happy because it was so easy. I walked down the street with a different step, a sloppier one. I ate in different places, developed different tastes. I decided years before what foods I would always say that I didn't like. Well, I like them now. I found a new apartment, and some people might have said it wasn't really very nice. It was smelly, I suppose, but I enjoyed it. There was a window that looked out on a courtyard full of dirt, and children played there, kind of slummy kinds of games. And you know how I'd always treated books with such respect? I would never even write in a book, or turn down a page, or throw a book casually onto a table. Well, one morning in my new apartment, I did something funny. At least I thought it was funny. I put a book of poetry into the bathtub, and I urinated on it. An interesting experiment. Then I left it in the tub, and then later, when I needed to shit, I hadn't planned this. It just came to me as an idea. Instead of shitting into the toilet, I shat on the book. Just to see, you know, if it could be done. And apparently it was possible, despite what anyone might have told me. So, like a scientist, I noted in my diary that night, yes, the experiment has been a complete success. My diary, by the way, had a pretty good title. I called it Experiments in Privacy. And you know, I'd never been able to stand dogs at all. All the dogs around Howard's house had driven me to the point of paralyzing rage. But now it so happened that I was talking to a boy who was playing in my courtyard, and he gave me his dog because he was leaving the city. And so the dog moved in with me, and it worked out quite well. We really enjoyed each other, as a matter of fact. But then the dog walked around the wrong corner and got shot, and the sweet little love story came to an end. Well, it came to an end the way so many seem to, in a pool of blood. And things got much, much quieter after that. Well, things were shrinking. Things were shrinking for me. Everything was shrinking. In fact, sometimes even trying to read the newspaper was sort of like spooning food into the mouth of someone who you happen to notice has suddenly died. So actually, the thing that became most real, most visible for me then, was this little collection of actually sex magazines, which I'd found in a rather nice plastic bag just lying on the street near a puddle. So I spent an awful lot of time with the rather arbitrarily selected group of individuals who happened to appear in those particular magazines. In fact, I got to know them awfully well. Their foibles, whatever, their idiosyncrasies, poses, gestures, expressions, smiles. And then that too was gone one day. One day it went. I looked at the pictures and got absolutely nothing. I felt nothing. I saw nothing. The pictures were dead. They were paper. They were nothing.
One day, inevitably, buying some flowers, I ran into Joan. And what could she do but invite me to visit? Coffee and buns in her backyard. Neat and tidy, but in the brilliant sunshine, I couldn't get warm. I felt soaking wet. The nice maid brought out a blanket and draped it carefully across my shoulders. There was no feeling at all between me and Joan, so I talked about myself. I talked without stopping for 2 hours about myself. pulling little sounds of understanding out of poor Joan's mouth the way in prison we pulled plates of food from slots in the doors. God, she was bored. But a few months later, she invited me again, and I sat in the kitchen while she cooked a stew. And as she worked away, stirring the big pot, she looked for all the world like a large rodent. Most days I stayed at home, made some food, played some music. But one night, it was not too long before Joan died, I actually ventured into the city, and I went to see a play, The Stone, by Abramovitz. I must say, I really loved it, and Lars Helbig especially in the role of the doctor. All that day, I thought about the play. And the next night, I had dinner with Joan. She'd seen the play the week before and had found it sentimental, and Helbig's acting she'd found very broad. When she said those things, the performance that was sitting in my mind was poisoned. It died. It died on contact with her words. Every moment, hopeful little face turned purple and died. In the days that followed, it was painful to revisit what had become of the memory I'd had. Finally, I emptied the whole evening out of my mind like trash.
It was one of those weeks when loose ends were being tied up. You know, once the people who do cause trouble are gone, then it's time to get the ones who might cause trouble, or the ones who might possibly have been able to cause trouble 20 years ago, or... Well, you know the whole story. Eventually, it's a matter of tying up loose ends. Tying up loose ends, or cutting them off, is just an inevitable part of the process, obviously. And so, of course, is the perennial parallel campaign for the betterment of humanity, or whatever you want to call it, in aid of which we were being treated now every week or so to demonstrations of a very new approach to executions, in which 8 or 10 people would be taken into a room, seated in these chairs that made their heads bend way back, and fitted up with brightly colored tubes in their mouths, which somehow did away with them with very little pain, in this rather odd ceremony, somehow with music or God knows what. So anyway, one morning I was sitting in my apartment reading in my newspaper about this latest attempt to elevate our moral and aesthetic taste, and I was looking at one of the photographs accompanying the article, and I happened to notice that among the bedraggled-looking people seated in those chairs being fitted with tubes were those rather tiresome moralists whom Howard had found so boring, Tom and Eddie. I quickly scanned the row for their former friend Martin until I remembered that he'd recently been appointed minister of supplementary tugboat rewiring or something of the sort. And then I happened to notice that the person who was seated in the very last chair with her head at that rather odd angle was obviously Judy. Well, I was lost, blinded, you know, like a caught fish flopping up and down on the floor of a boat. And the strange thing was that apart from sweating and sort of panting, well, more or less exactly as people say when they speak about such moments, I didn't know what to do. I mean, literally, what to do? Stand up, remain seated, stay in, go out? I reached for my naked friends in the plastic bag because there they were on the table right next to me. I looked at them all in the midst of their playing, and their hopeful smiles made me wonder if a more compassionate world might not perhaps come about one day. I went out. It was a black afternoon, and I wandered through the streets, oppressed somehow by an odd sadness. Everywhere I went, the leaves had turned. Traitors? I mean, had they no shame? Oh, well, that sort of thing had been going on for quite some time. One noticed the usual golds and browns and oranges amidst the green. I went into the park. I sat down on a bench. I seemed to have developed some variety of what I believe is sometimes called hysterical coughing. And then it suddenly hit me that everyone on earth who could read John Donne was now dead. They were all dead. And as I turned that odd fragment of information around in my mind, I realized that I was the only one left who would even be aware of the passing of this peculiar group. This group which was so special, at least in their own eyes. And my mind went back to a book I'd read when I was very young about a boy who'd belonged to an ancient tribe in a distant land. And in the course of describing all the customs of the tribe, the book had explained that within the tribe there were many different subgroups or clans, and that whenever the last surviving member of one of these clans would die, well, there would naturally be no one left from their family to mourn them. So then someone who had known that last survivor, and if there was no one left who had known them well, then it would simply be someone who had known them a little, would be appointed to mourn publicly in a sacred spot the passing of that whole extinguished clan, the designated mourner. And I recalled how the boy in the book had performed that function on a certain occasion, lighting a magnificent sacred fire, weeping and remembering. Well, quite nearby in the center of the park stood that rather dark, cavernous, and always overcrowded cafe to whose allure all visitors to the park would eventually succumb on even the nicest days, despite the well-known quality of its ambiance and food. And I wandered over toward it, went inside, found a table, and ordered a cup of tea from an overworked waitress. Well, along with the tea, and of her own volition, apparently, or maybe it was the policy of the cafe's management, the waitress brought a plate which held a small pastry, a sticky kind of cake whose bottom rested on a bit of paper. And as the waitress left me, I saw my opportunity. First, obviously, I ate the cake. Then I grabbed some matches, which sat nearby me, and I glanced around, and I lit the bit of paper. I am the designated mourner, I said. The bit of paper wasn't very big, but it burned rather slowly because of the cake crumbs. I felt I heard John Donne weeping into a handkerchief as he fell through the floor, plummeting through the earth on his way to hell. His name, once said by so many to be immortal, would not be remembered, it turned out. The rememberers were gone, except for me. And I was forgetting. Forgetting his name. Forgetting him. And forgetting all the ones who remembered him. A few patrons and waitresses looked over at me irritably until the fire went out. Then I left the place and I was back in the park. Would you believe that things were already more peaceful? Well, they were, frankly. I could even feel myself breathing more easily and deeply. Everyone I saw looked calmer than before. We all were just doing much better in every way, without the presence on the earth of our nerve-jangling friends, the dear departed Moornees, if that's the right word. I sat back down on the bench I'd been sitting on before. The sun was going down, and I have to say that the colors in the park were quite extraordinary, almost edible, one would have to say. The air was a kind of rose color, and the light which ran through it was a twinkling yellow. What were we waiting for? The appearance of the Messiah? Was all this nothing? I was quite fed up with the search for perfection and quite amazed by all that I had. The lemonade stand with its lemonade, the cafe with its irritable customers and staff, the carousel, the birds, the squirrels, the trees. I'm sorry, Howard. Your favorite grove was cut down. But so much remains. This light, so beautiful and warm, was not cut down. The flowers at my feet with their petals that kiss my ankles like little lips were not cut down. The trembling air and the trembling sky were not cut down. It said in the newspaper that there will be fireworks tonight above the carousel, and right nearby a parade of young dogs, including some of the newest breeds, some for sale. I sat on the bench for a very long time, lost, sunk deep in the experience of unbelievable physical pleasure, perhaps the greatest pleasure we can know on this earth, the sweet, ever-changing caress of an early evening breeze.
You've been listening to The Designated Mourner, written by Wallace Shawn, who played the role of Jack. Judy was played by Deborah Eisenberg, and Larry Pine played the part of Howard. The play was directed by Andre Gregory, with music and sound design by Bruce Odland. The original theatrical production of The Designated Mourner was co-created by Jennifer Tipton and was made possible by Celeste Bartos and Scott Rudin. The Designated Mourner has been published in paperback by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. If you'd like to hear this radio production again, you can hear it on the web at nextbigthing.org, and from there, you can send us comments. This has been a presentation of the WNYC program, The Next Big Thing, produced for radio by Curtis Fox, with engineering help from George Wellington and Irene Trudell. Thanks go out to Elizabeth Puccini. I'm Dean Olscher.
Thank you.